Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks USA episode number 10, and this week I'm going to be looking at the issue of voting restrictions in place in America, and essentially the ways in which state legislatures are attempting to restrict either the ability to vote or access to the ballot box. Now there's four key areas that I'm going to be looking at here. One is, very briefly, an overview of gerrymandering. Then restrictions that have been put in place on early voting. The controversial voter ID laws. And finishing off by looking at the issue of prisoner voting. And those are four key areas where particularly Republican state legislatures and governors are trying to put restrictions in place which will dampen or weaken the voice of the, if you like, the new Democrat coalition, mainly African Americans, Hispanics, the poor, the young, and the elderly poor. So how do all these work? Well, with the issue of gerrymandering, we've seen a rise, actually going back to the sort of 1980s, 1990s, of increasingly bizarre districts being drawn. Now, in most states, it's up to the state legislatures to draw the congressional districts and allocate those votes accordingly. And what started happening in the late 1980s, early 1990s, was that there was a movement to create more minority-majority constituencies. This was as a means of trying to encourage more African Americans and other minorities as well, or not to encourage so much as to allow them access to congressional districts to increase representation. So you got things like the famous Earmuff District in New York, two largely African American areas joined by one tiny strip of road, sort of looked a little bit, if you squinted at it, like a pair of earmuffs. And the idea there was that a majority of the population would be African American and therefore they'd be more likely to vote for an African American representative. Now, this became a successful strategy at the time, mainly because of Republican Party support, because a number of Republican legislatures realised that by creating minority-majority districts and knowing that the overwhelming majority of African Americans tended to vote Democrat, you could basically funnel all the Democrat voters, or a large majority of Democrat voters, into one or two districts, thus leaving all the other districts free for a Republican challenge. Now, there's nothing new about this. Both parties have been redrawing districts for their own benefit for many, many years. But since 2010, this has gone on at a huge pace. And actually, after the case of Shaw versus Reno in 1993, racial gerrymandering, that is redistricting based purely on race, so the minority-majority constituencies, had to be held to strict scrutiny. So effectively, creating minority-majority constituencies simply for a racial reason was effectively banned by the Supreme Court. But of course, what they're still allowed to do is to do political gerrymandering. So although they can't do it with the intention of creating minority-majority districts, there's nothing in place. Well, there was strict scrutiny, so there had to be a review of the process. But state legislatures could redraw districts to benefit their own party by putting, say, urban voters, which is sort of code for African Americans, urban voters into one huge district, thus leaving many other districts to be divided up. Now, for this reason, if we look at a couple of examples, in the state of Ohio, gerrymandering resulted in only four of the 16 congressional districts going Democrat in 2012. Now, you may say, well, maybe that's fair enough. Maybe that's how the results were apportioned. But actually, over half the votes cast for the House of Representatives in 2012 in Ohio were for Democrats. They got over half the vote, but only a quarter of the seats. And this is a state that was won by Barack Obama with over 50% of the vote. So the result of gerrymandering is that the Democrat representatives or the Democrat electorate is being marginalised. And it means that one person, one vote isn't really applying. Huge districts with a disproportionate size of the population are being drawn up, basically to make sure traditional Democrat groups, such as African Americans and Hispanics, would be all grouped together in one huge district, leaving the others free for the Republican parties to pick up. The same is true in North Carolina, where after the 2010 redistricting, we saw in 2012 that the Democrats actually won in North Carolina. If you added up all the House races, they got over 50% of the vote, and yet they only won 4 of the 13 seats that North Carolina had. So we've got a situation where, as a result of gerrymandering, the voices of core Democratic groups, Hispanics, African Americans, the poor and the young, are basically being marginalised and their voices are not being heard. And this may in part explain why there's growing racial tensions and discontent in America. So gerrymandering is a key part for voter suppression. And it's been an issue with the partisan divide as well, as the Republican Party see their voting base of middle-class, elderly, white people declining at the expense of these minority groups. Rather than appeal to those minority groups, they're finding ways of marginalising their voice, and gerrymandering has been a very effective way of doing that. It's worth bearing in mind that if you count up the votes cast nationally for the House of Representatives in 2012, the Democrats actually won the House, and yet the Republicans, thanks to gerrymandering, had a sizable majority in the House. So again, it's showing the undemocratic nature of American politics as it currently stands. Now, going further than this, looking at what it takes to actually be able to cast the vote. And the first thing you've got to do is register to vote. And again, this is taking a number of forms. In states like California and Oregon, the state legislatures and governors there, notice two traditionally Democrat states, have introduced new laws that basically automatically enroll people when they renew their driver's license for the electoral register. And basically, if you're not registered, you can't vote. So this is a way of expanding the franchise and making it easier for people to register. However, in other states like New Jersey, they're actually making it more restrictive. So Chris Christie, as governor of New Jersey, has actually said, is it too much to ask for someone to fill in a form? And how those forms are being filled in plays a key role in whether or not people are eligible to vote, whether or not they're even registered to have a vote. If we go back to Ohio in 2012 and the case of Republican Secretary of State John Husted, who I've mentioned in a previous episode, he actually came up with a way of trying to frustrate voters by making them fill in a form themselves rather than having a registered official help them fill it in, and thereby if there were any mistakes, their votes would not be counted. So again, and these forms are quite complicated. It's not just a ticky box exercise, and these complicated forms, particularly for the poor, maybe those whose first language isn't English, as might affect the Hispanic or those from low education backgrounds, might struggle to fill in these forms, and you've then got people looking for any minor mistake in an attempt to restrict the right to vote. So we've got this sort of split across America where some states are making it tougher to register to vote, while other states are making it much easier to get on the vote. And these are very much along partisan lines. So in California, they're trying to make it easier to boost Democrat turnout of core groups, whereas in swing states like Ohio, possibly New Jersey, although it's usually Democrat, and Florida, they're actually making it much tougher. Now, having got registered to vote, having got your ballot, you've then got to actually go and cast it. Now, this can be problematic for a lot of people in America. The districts are normally quite large and you can be quite a distance away from a polling station. So access to the ballot box is crucial. And this has been one of the areas where we've seen state officials trying to restrict access to the ballot box. So not necessarily access to the ballot, to the voting slip, but certainly to making it a challenge to get to the ballot box. Each state is in charge of its own voting times and schedules, and so there's no exact answer here, but usually they're open, most states are open for about 12 hours, usually somewhere between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., maybe 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. It does vary across the state, some slightly longer. But these timings, these 12-hour slots, can cause problems for people, say people who work long hours or shift work or have children. They're not able to get to the polling station. And when they do get there, because especially in urban areas, the queues can be very, very long as people have to go through, get processed, especially with these new forms, which are getting checked regularly. They get given the ballot. It can take a long time. And then there's the transport issue as well, if you are from a fair way away. So a number of states have toyed with the idea or have implemented ideas trying to increase early voting. So allowing people to cast their ballots earlier, some up to a week or 10 days beforehand. Others introducing mail ballots. So in states like Colorado, they've introduced all ballot access, all mail ballot access. So you don't have to go in queue. You can just fill in your ballots, get it in the post, and you'll be voted. But in a lot of other states, they're actually trying to restrict them. Now, these are not necessarily done by laws. These are done by the executives within these states. So we don't know what will happen exactly in 2016. But a couple of cases in two key swing states from 2012 give us an indication of what sort of actions can happen to deny people the right to vote. So in Florida in 2012, they restricted the number of days for early voting from 14 to 8. Again, so trying to limit the turnout. And those people that take advantage of early voting tend to be poorer, the young, from minority communities in urban areas, African-Americans and Hispanics, the core Democrat voter base. So by restricting it to the 8, the hope was that Florida would swing to the Republicans. They also banned Sunday voting on the Sunday before the election. So, and the polling stations are open, people go and queue up. And this was very much a target towards African Americans, so-called souls to the polls, in which after attending church on a Sunday morning, the church community or community activists would lay on buses or coaches to take people to the polls as a sort of community activity. By banning it on Sunday, the hope was to try and target the African-American community and make it less likely that they would turn out to vote. Now, of course, as well as trying to put off African-Americans from voting, what you're also doing is limiting the amount of time for people to vote. So that can lead to huge queues. And the hope there was people who are busy or have jobs would look at the queues and would be put off voting. Now, in 2012, number of people defied this. We can't quantify what effect it did have. But people would apparently queue for 8 or 9 hours to cast their ballot. And there is a consideration, would they do that for Hillary Clinton if she becomes the Democrat nominee? They did it for Obama. There was the racial dimension there and the support for him. Would they be willing to queue for 8 hours for Hillary Clinton? And that's possibly the concern for the Democrats if this was to repeat itself in 2016. Now, if we move on to Ohio, where John Husted, the Republican Secretary of State, took a role. He, again, tried to restrict access to the ballot box in order to swing the state for Mitt Romney. He tried to prevent early voting in urban areas, which is closed for African Americans, while expanding opportunities for those rural areas, which is code for white Americans, lived. After his plan was shot down by the courts, Husted banned early voting on all 3 days immediately before the election. So effectively, he removed it again to target poor and minority communities. That was overturned by the federal court. They said, no, you have to give back early voting on those 3 days because those are kind of the big days. So Husted said, OK, I'll open them. But he reduced the hours that they could be cast. The court again struck this down. But then he introduced these tougher applications for provisional ballots to try and discourage people from voting and deny them the right to vote. Effectively, what Husted was doing was introducing his own modern equivalent of the literacy test, a means for allowing white voters or coded white voters or at least Republican supporters easier access to the ballot and denying those groups of voters that would traditionally vote Democrat from gaining access to the ballot box. Now, we won't know until November what will happen in 2016. But with the removal of the restrictions on the Voting Rights Act or the coordination that would have occurred, thanks to the Voting Rights Act, since that was struck down in Shelby County versus Holder, it could be more severe. So that's something to be aware of. And again, undermines the idea of democracy functioning well in America today. So next we'll move on to the more famous voting restrictions, and that's the issue of voter ID. Now, this played a massive role in the run-up to the 2012 presidential election. It was struck down, or the restrictions were largely struck down under the Voting Rights Act before the 2012 presidential election. But since the formula for that was struck down in Shelby County versus Holder, more restrictions have come back. And it's likely that these increased demands are going to be a major factor in the 2016 presidential election. As things stand, there are 16 states that have new voting restrictions in place for the first time in a presidential election. And they range from strict photo ID requirements to other early voting cutbacks to registration restrictions. Now, those 16 states include some key ones, including New Hampshire, Ohio, Texas, Ohio, and Virginia, as well as Florida. So those are four key swing states, Ohio, Florida, and Virginia, basically being the three largest swing states up for grabs. And New Hampshire, although it's small, another key swing state. So again, it looks bad for the Democrats with these tougher restrictions in place and without the ability to repeal them. These 16 states are joined by another five who, since 2010 and the midterms there, have introduced tougher voting restrictions. And again, this is very much with the idea of limiting the Democrat supporters' voice. Now, the usual justification for tougher voter ID laws is to try and prevent fraudulent voting. And that certainly seems a worthy cause. But the thing is, it's a non-issue in American politics. In most of these states, there have been no reported cases of voter fraud for decades. And even when it does happen, it is very rare indeed. We're talking maybe a dozen cases in an electoral cycle in any state at any one moment. It's really a non-issue. If that were genuinely the reason why stricter voter ID laws were being introduced, then it does seem as a massive overkill and overreach for a thing that isn't really an issue or a problem. Now, while the official line taken is that you need voting ID to prevent fraud, that's a sort of official message, sometimes Republican lawmakers have gone off message and given a hint as to their true intentions for these more restrictive laws. A good example of this was Mike Turzai, that's T-U-R-Z-A-I, who was the Republican leader of the state's House of Representatives in the run-up to the 2012 election. And he gave this boast, and I'm quoting here, "Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania, done." And that would seem to clearly indicate a partisan aspect in the fact that they're trying to swing the state, use voter ID laws to swing Pennsylvania towards the Republicans. Just in case we weren't clear on that one, in an interview after the 2012 presidential election, Pennsylvania Republican Chairman Rob Gleason was asked what he thought about voter ID laws. He said he thought it had made the situation better, okay, his words, better, because voter ID laws had cut Barack Obama's victory rate from 10% over John McCain in 2008 to 5% over Mitt Romney. And he clearly stated in the interview that he felt voter ID laws were the reason for that. Now, as a Republican, you may feel that is better. And as a Republican supporter, you may feel that is better. But from a Democratic point of view, that is clear naked partisan politicking, trying to prevent the voters from gaining access to the box, making it difficult, and trying to cut the percentage. And obviously, a 5% margin in what has traditionally been a swing state, Pennsylvania seems to be leaning much more Democrat these days, but that 5% could prove to be crucial in the forthcoming election. And in 2012, most of these voter ID laws had actually been suspended just before the presidential election took place. So it was the legacy that really had the effect here. But this isn't just happening in Pennsylvania. One of the advisors to Republican Governor John Kasich in the state of Ohio basically defended the governor's decree that limited early voting drastically by saying, and I'm quoting here, "We shouldn't contort the voting process to accommodate the urban, read African-American, voter turnout machine," end quote. Again, clearly a racial dimension, but also the implication that the Democrats get African-Americans to turn out to vote. African-Americans overwhelmingly vote Democrat, so therefore they should not accommodate these voters. And relatively recently, a Republican official in North Carolina had to resign after they touted ID cards as a way to reduce voting by, quote, "a bunch of lazy blacks that wants the government to give them everything," end quote. So across three states, and remember, although North Carolina is pretty much seen as a safe Republican state, these are Ohio, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina have been swing states. They have, Pennsylvania traditionally used to be very much so, Ohio is the ultimate bellwether, and North Carolina in 2008 voted Obama, and in 2012 voted Romney. So these are three crucial states where minorities are, or the Republicans have slipped up in some way, and hinted that the real motive was simply to stop black voters getting to the polls to try and swing their states towards the Republican candidate. Now, even though just before the 2014 presidential, the 2012 presidential election, even though the Supreme Court struck down a lot of these restrictions as unconstitutional under the Voting Rights Act, a number of Republican Party officials and candidates still use them as propaganda to dissuade minority groups from voting. So, for example, in Wisconsin, where free ID cards were issued by the Department of Transportation, and that would have been absolutely fine, so it wouldn't have cost anything, could have been done in advance, the Republican state government ordered Department of Transport officials to withhold information about the cards, so deliberately restricting access to them. That was headed by Governor Scott Walker. You also got the situation where in many cities, billboards and poster adverts were put up in predominantly black and Hispanic neighbourhoods suggesting photo IDs would be required to vote, even if that was not the case, in an attempt to dissuade or discourage these voters from actually going to the polls. So feeding clear misinformation. Now, obviously, in 2012, this didn't seem to have an effect on the presidential election. It may have had an effect on the extent of Obama's win, but certainly Obama won. However, there may be an issue for the future. As I said, a lot of these laws were struck down, or at least suspended, under the Voting Rights Act. So the impact may have been tempered somewhat. However, since the Supreme Court struck down the formula used to determine which areas or which states had to get pre-clearance from Congress before they make any changes to voting laws, since they removed the formula, they've effectively invalidated the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and allowed many more states to change their voting laws. And it's telling that Greg Abbott is governor of Texas, basically within hours of the ruling in Shelby County, reinstated the controversial voter ID law that had previously been ruled unconstitutional. So it was a clear and active attempt to restrict the voters. And in the run-up to the 2014 election, it may well have had an impact. So as things stand in February 2016, I just want to sort of go over some of the new restrictions that have been put in place in certain key states. So in Ohio, since Shelby County in 2014, the Republican-controlled state legislature passed a series of voting restrictions, which was signed by John Kasich. Now, so these were for the 2014 elections. They cut 6 days of early voting. They basically eliminated the Golden Week, which voters could register and cast a ballot all in one trip. So the week before the election, you could register and vote all in one go. You didn't have to queue up twice. They also changed absentee and provisional ballot rules to make it tougher if you couldn't access the ballot. They also, John Husted, again, also issued a directive reducing early voting on weekday evenings and weekends. Now, there has been a reaction to that. In 2015, state officials and voting rights advocates settled a lawsuit over the early voting hours, and it's restored one day of Sunday voting, and it has added early voting hours on weekday evenings. And that's in place until 2018. So it has improved the situation slightly in Ohio for this year, but it's still markedly less access to the polls or opportunity to vote than were in place for the 2012 presidential election. In the state of Virginia, since 2014, there's been restriction on third-party voter registration, which requires groups receiving 25 or more registration forms to register with the state and reduces the amount of time from 15 to 10 days to deliver the applications. So that's in a hospital or a nursing home or a community centre, somewhere like that, where people would gather the forms to help people fill them in. The state Senate is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, but the Republican Lieutenant Governor cast the tie-breaking vote on a photo ID law. The state house is controlled by Republicans, and both measures were signed by a Republican governor in 2013. So in 2015, the Republican legislature passed a bill to amend the photo ID law to add student IDs issued by private schools to the list of acceptable IDs. The law currently allows public school IDs. That one was signed by a Republican governor, but again, ask yourself which students tend to go to private schools and why those IDs would become acceptable. In 2011, Florida's also passed more restrictions on voter registration drives, actually making it harder for people to register to vote in the first place. So again, putting more obstacles in the way of people voting. Federal court did try and prevent some of that in 2012, but as a result of Shelby County, there is now far fewer voting days than there were in 2012, and it's harder to get people registered to vote. Now, if we come to Texas, and there's been a lot about Texas, obviously it's safely Republican at the moment, but there has been speculation that with the rising Hispanic population in Texas, that if not for 2016, then possibly for 2020, Texas may become a swing state. Now, if that happens, the Republicans are in serious trouble. Texas is by far the largest state regularly voting Republican. So it's perhaps telling there that probably the most restrictive voting rights laws are to be found in Texas. Now, there have been a lot of challenges here. But in 2015, the Republican legislature passed a bill to provide a certified copy of a Texas birth certificate free of charge to a voter who states she is seeking to obtain an election identification certificate, which is one of the forms of ID accepted under the state's strict photo ID law. Now, the implication of that is that in order to get one of these voter identification cards, you need a Texas birth certificate, not just an American birth certificate, but a Texan birth certificate. The likelihood there is it's targeting people who are not born in Texas, particularly people not born in the United States. that would be people that have either legally or possibly illegally entered America but don't have a Texas birth certificate. So it's preventing a large swathe of Hispanics from voting. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that there's currently a Supreme Court case in Evanwell versus Abbott, in which Evanwell is trying to suggest that when it comes to allocating districts and cutting the allocating the size of districts, only eligible voters should be considered. Abbott's actually challenging this and saying, no, you should count all potential voters. So that's when allocating a share of seats for the House of Representatives, you should take into account those that are under 18, prisoners or felons who aren't eligible to vote, and illegal immigrants, or even legal immigrants that don't have the right to vote. It's an interesting one because, of course, with these voter ID laws, by basically suggesting that you have to be have a Texas birth certificate to be able to get an ID card to be able to vote, you're kind of saying you want the representation that's granted from having these people in your state, which is why Texas has gone from 34 to 38 representatives since 2010. But you don't want to give them the right to vote. And worryingly, although not quite at the same level, that's very similar to the sort of three-fifths clause that was originally in the Constitution. Basically, we want to gain representation from our southern states, from our slaves, but we're not going to allow our slaves the right to vote. And that seems to be what Abbott's going to be arguing and defending in Evanwell versus Abbott, that in Texas, the young and the Hispanic immigrants should be counted for allocating seats, but they're making it difficult to allow them the right to vote. So in which case, again, one person, one vote will not be applied in the state of Texas if that is the case, and there will be issues over fair representation. So that's the issue with voter ID laws. It's probably going to change. There's lots of challenges and reforms coming. But it is important to note this, partly for party politics, but also for the nature of American elections and the way they're being conducted. And there are questions for how the quality of American democracy as things currently stand. Now, the last thing that I'm going to look at is the issue of felon voting. So those are people, well, I'm not going to focus on the felons themselves, but it's people that have served their sentences and the restrictions on them being given the right to vote. Basically, America is one of the very few, I can't actually think of another Western country, Western democracy that does this. Not only does it prevent its prisoners or those serving a sentence from voting, that's certainly not unusual, we do that in the UK as well, but equally they make it very difficult, if not impossible, for most of those people to regain the right to vote once they have finished serving their sentence. Now, the whole idea of sort of prison service and so on is that once you've served your sentence, you're effectively a free citizen again. You've paid your dues to society, and traditionally you'd argue should be restored your full rights. However, that doesn't happen in America, and certainly not as a matter of course, and quite a few of the tougher restrictions that have been put in place in places like Florida and Texas have been to make it much more difficult for felons to regain the right to vote. Now, you may be thinking, well, so what? If you've committed a crime, then you do lose certain rights. Well, certainly while you're carrying out the sentence, yes, you may well lose that right to vote. But if you have been incarcerated or sent to prison for something possibly relatively minor, maybe for a month or 2 months, does that mean you should lose the right to vote for the rest of your life? And in a liberal democracy, the argument would be no. Once you've served your sentence, you are restored to full rights. But again, we see here a pattern that is very much going against the Democrat coalition. For a start, thanks to the introduction of mandatory minimums for certain crimes, and also states like California have a three strikes and you're out rule. The prison population across America has increased exponentially. Some estimates vary, but the International Center for Prison Studies and the Sentencing Project, two groups that investigate this, they reckon that it's about 2.2 million people are incarcerated, or basically a 500% increase since 1978. Now, that's probably at the upper end of the spectrum of various estimates, but there has been a huge increase. But if we go with that, then basically Americans are currently imprisoning their population at a rate of 716 per 100,000, or about 7 and a bit percent, which is the highest rate of incarceration in the world. So America is locking up more of its population than before. And of course, this 7 and a bit percent, even once they finish serving their sentence, either being released from prison or having served probation, still won't get the right to vote back. Now, you might argue that isn't that going to affect both parties equally? And the answer is no, because we need to consider the racial dimension of the American prison population. For a start, the incarceration rates of African Americans, as an example, this is from 1999, were 8.2 times the incarceration rate for non-Hispanic whites. Basically, for every single white person in jail, there are at least 8 black prisoners in America. And that was in 1999. It's estimated that about 16.6% of adult African American males in 2001 were current or former state or federal prisoners, which is twice the rate for Hispanics and 6 times that for white males, who are at 2.6%. 60% of all inmates in US prisons were from minorities, either African Americans, who made up about 41%, and Hispanics, who made up 19%, with the white prison population being only about 34%. Even though, if you add them together, black and Hispanic voters barely make up a quarter of the US population. And if these rates continue, there's no guarantee that they will, but if these rates continue, then it's estimated that 1 in 3 African-American males and 1 in 6 Hispanic males, compared to 1 in 17 white males, are expected to go to prison at some point during their lifetime. So what does this mean? Well, not only is America incarcerating more of its population than any other equivalent country, well, any other country in the world, but disproportionately, those citizens are from minority groups and overwhelmingly from poor and underprivileged backgrounds. Effectively, we're talking about Democratic voters. Now, we're not saying, or I'm not saying, that people who are currently serving a sentence should be given the right to vote. But the implication that people who have served their sentence should not have their votes restored or their voting rights restored raises questions for the whole process of rehabilitation and reintroducing people to their society. The idea is, once you've served your sentence, you have paid your dues and you should go back to being a citizen again. If you are disenfranchised by losing your right to vote for the rest of your life, then you are not a full and active citizen and you can never be fully integrated again, which is going to lead to disengagement with the disengagement with the political system, and possibly lead to more problems in the future. This is particularly telling when you get a situation where someone has been arrested for something relatively minor and convicted for a relatively minor crime, not to dismiss it, but we could be talking about sort of basic theft as a teenager, well, someone over 18, or some sort of assault or something that they deserve to be punished for, but that then prevents them for the rest of their life being able to exercise the vote. And of course, these increased restrictions on prisoners' voting rights disproportionately affect Hispanics and African Americans, who overwhelmingly have been voting Democrat. So it's another means of restricting American democracy, but also restricting that coalition of groups that are growing as a percentage of the American population and overwhelmingly have been backing the Democrats. So if you put all these points together, the gerrymandering, the difficulty of registering people early and the restrictions on getting people registered early, the restrictions on early voting, the increasing difficulty of acquiring voter ID laws and the restrictions on what counts as voter ID law, and the restrictions on prisoners' right to vote. And you have a situation where predominantly Republican legislatures and executives are finding a way of marginalising and disenfranchising minority voices in the American electorate. And those minority voices tend to vote Democrat, as well as being a growing share. So it seems to be a policy which is not officially stated, but certainly a hint at by people like Rob Beeson, that the Republican Party are trying to restrict those people from voting who would tend to favour the Democrat Party. And that is a really terrifying sign for American democracy, and something that institutions like the Brennan Center and some other state legislatures are looking to combat and challenge. But without a new Voting Rights Act, it's not clear whether this is going to be solved anytime soon. And it could well make the difference in the balance of power. And I'll leave you with this sort of final thought. Based on the research of Uggen and Manza, that's Uggen, U-G-G-E-N, and Manza, M-A-N-Z-A. They've done some work into felon voting. And I'm just going to read you this little extract from their 2002 book, Democratic Contraction, Political Consequences of Felon Disenfranchisement in the United States, which was, not from their book, an article published in American Sociological Review 67. And in it they say, and I'm quoting here, "Because felons are drawn disproportionately from the ranks of racial minorities and the poor, disenfranchisement laws tend to take more voters from the Democratic than from Republican candidates. Analysis shows that felon disenfranchisement played a decisive role in US Senate elections in recent years. Moreover, at least one Republican presidential victory would have been reversed if former felons had been allowed to vote, and at least one Democratic presidential victory would have been jeopardized had contemporary rates of disenfranchisement prevailed during that time." End quote. That was in 2002. And the situation has got much, much worse, and the implications much bigger since then, with a much higher proportion of American citizens being incarcerated now than they were in 2002, and a much higher proportion of the population coming from African American and Hispanic communities. So we can see there that there is a clear issue with voting rights in America. So I hope that's given you some food for thought. And next week I'll come back looking at a slightly different issue, which I haven't made up my mind yet. But I hope you've got something out of that, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.